On Reality Check this week, we have Bill Bradbury. He is the former Oregon Secretary of State and a climate reality leader and mentor. He's with us to tell us a little bit about the current political situation around climate change and really all things climate related. So excited to have you here, Bill. Thank you.
Real pleasure to be here. It's great to be back here. I served as the state representative for the Southern Oregon coast, including Brookings, and then I served as the state senator back when the state senate senator represented Curry County, Coos County, and parts of western Douglas County. And then I was elected Secretary of State and served the whole state, and we implemented vote by mail. So lots of great experiences.
Feel so privileged to have you here with all that background and really the insider kind of point of view about politics as they relate to climate change and what it's going to take to really make that those things happen that we need to get through the legislature. It was such a disappointment when H.R. 2020 didn't go through in this state of all places.
The only place that something like House Bill 2020 has been enacted is the state just to our south, state of California, has enacted some legislation relating to controlling carbon. I was really disappointed to see the Republicans that basically just decided that they were going to do something that's pretty unusual in the legislative process, which is just walk away. And that denied the legislature a quorum. There are 11 Republicans and 19 Democrats, and it takes 20 to have a quorum. So they denied the legislature a quorum for 11 days and forced the legislature to give up on very aggressive, innovative climate legislation, and instead they just really had to get all the other stuff enacted that they have to get done before they end their session, which they did, but it's very discouraging to me that...
Oh, it was for everybody. So basically, did they just stay away long enough to run out the clock, so to speak, or was it more like, we're going to stay away until you negotiate us back in by giving this up?
Right. Well, that's what
both
happened.
Both of the above.
The clock ran until the end of June. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a new deal. The legislature can meet every year. They can meet every year, but the first session is about 6 months, and the second session is much shorter. And this was the longer session, but it ended at the end of June, so they just walked until the Democratic majority agreed to give up on the climate bill. And that's what happened.
Wow.
And then they came back for the last 4 or 5 days and enacted a huge amount of legislation in 4 or 5 days, not including the climate bill.
So I want to come back to the whole political side of things, but before we, I want to ask you some more things about, you know, your own process in getting into climate and
sure.
so forth. But
sure.
before we leave HR 2020, what's coming up? How do you see that? Is that going to be up again soon? What's the future of 2020 or something like it?
Well, I don't know. I'm not in the legislature anymore, so I don't really know what the future of 2020 is. I can report that I was at the last week, I was at the Coastal Caucus Summit held in Florence. Basically, folks who support 2020 said they're going to bring it back into the next session of the legislature, which begins in January of 2020.
And then we'll have new legislators in there.
No.
I
don't think we will. No, I don't think so. The general election is not
till
this
after
fall.
Okay.
So it's next year.
Next year.
So it's very interesting because they said they're going to bring it back in 2020. And I sort of wondered, well, what's different between 2019 and 2020 that makes you want to. I'm glad they're bringing it back.
Uh-huh.
I don't want it to die, but I don't really know what's different in 2020 as opposed to 2019.
Well, let's come back to that because I think it's such an important subject that you know so much about and really such a resource. But I want to be sure and ask you about how did you transition from being in politics to becoming so passionate about climate? What was your process?
Well, it started in 2006,
uh-huh.
which is, 13 years ago? Hard to believe.
Yeah.
But started in 2006 while I was Oregon Secretary of State, and Al Gore, who had done An Inconvenient Truth, he had been traveling all over the country giving slideshows about climate change, and he did a movie that was quite successful, An Inconvenient Truth, and he called me up and said, how would you like to come to the first training I'm going to do to try to get more climate reality leaders giving this presentation? So I was obviously thrilled.
Right.
And I went back to Al Gore's barn in
Tennessee,
in Carthage, Tennessee,
uh-huh.
near Nashville. There were 50 of us there, and it was really the first effort that Al Gore had ever made to try to train other people. He decided, well, maybe I should try to train some other people to get more people involved, because I just can't reach enough people
yeah.
with the slideshows that I do. So it was an amazing group of 50, people who just really got trained. And like I said, we did the first day of the training in his barn in Carthage, Tennessee, the second day of the training at a Holiday Inn in, nearby.
Mm-hmm.
What's really interesting to me is that over the time that I've given this climate show, it's changed a lot.
Oh, I bet.
And what's changed most in the climate show is that in 2006, there was a whole lot of sort of projecting what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean,
right.
There were examples of hurricanes, but it was mostly projection about what could happen. In 2019, virtually 90% of the slides I show are from 2019 and 2018.
Things are moving so fast.
It is moving so much faster than scientists thought it would. The climate is rapidly changing.
Yeah.
We saw it here. With the fires last year. Just, that's one of the things that happens in climate change is you get just extraordinary fires. The whole West Coast last year.
It was crazy.
The Chetco Bar fire here,
mm-hmm.
And then the wine country, Napa, Northern California fires, and then Los Angeles, Southern California
mm-hmm.
fires. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the whole West Coast.
I was on,
consumed by
yeah,
fire.
I was on an airplane crossing Oregon, and a little tiny window at 30,000 feet or whatever it is. You don't see too much land in one screenshot of that.
No.
And from the time we hit Oregon border to the time we hit the other border, there was never a moment that there wasn't a fire in that screen.
Wow.
Oftentimes multiples, and sometimes I could even see the flames from that height. It was crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So,
and they're different kinds of fires, too. I mean, they're so super hot.
Well, they just burn very, very quickly.
Because
the reality is that the forests have gotten way more dried out than they traditionally have because you're basically experiencing this change in climate that leads to exceptional drying. So it's kind of bizarre because in climate change, you get exceptional flooding
mm-hmm.
on one hand. And on the other hand, you get exceptional drying. You get smaller and smaller glaciers because what precipitation comes more often as rain rather than snow. So what we're used to when I was growing up, Mount Hood was really covered with snow.
Oh, yeah.
And now, if you look at a picture of Mount Hood, August of 2003 versus August 2018, totally different. I mean, totally bare in 2018.
Yeah.
I mean, not totally, but virtually bare.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it, compared to the glaciers that were there in 2003.
And everything is just that much more extreme. And so if the rain is falling, it's falling really, really hard so the earth can't absorb it and it just runs off into the ocean,
right,
taking all the soil with it. I mean, it's a bunch of dominoes all falling.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's pretty phenomenal. So, and I think, I do believe that there's an increasing understanding that the climate is changing, and there's increasing acceptance that the climate is changing. There used to be a whole lot of deniers.
Yes.
And given the extreme weather we've had in the last 10 years, people have sort of not been so into denying, except for our president,
mm-hmm.
who basically, Donald Trump says climate change is made up.
Yeah.
And it's not happening.
Well, he's not real good at taking in reality.
No, I don't think so. But it's really, to me, very, very sad that we go from a president, Barack Obama, who was really, and George Bush before him, presidents who were really sort of serious about dealing with the change, as opposed to a president who says, oh, it's not real.
It's
just weather.
He so set us back.
Right. It's really,
I just had Tom Suchanek in for a recording. It's not going to come out for a few months yet for listeners because he's going to be presenting in October and at the library. So we're kind of holding that one in the back for a while. But
okay.
He made a strong statement. And he's, I don't know if you know the man, but he's a very science-oriented fellow. And really on top of that side of things. And he made the statement that the technology already exists to manage the problem. What we're dealing with now is only the will of the people. And I thought that was an amazing statement. It really turned my thinking around because I've been like so many people, I think, walking around going, can we fix it? Is it possible to fix it? And apparently it is. Is that something that would...
I'm not aware, I'm not up to date, I guess I'd say, in terms of...
The science isn't your thing.
I'm not aware that it's really possible to fix it.
Uh-huh.
I would love it if it was true, but I've not really heard that.
Yeah.
I would love to know more about that.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
I certainly hope... that we can, the first step is to stop making the problem worse.
Right.
The second step is to try to do what you can to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'd be wonderful if we could get more and more carbon.
And he wasn't saying that we could just sit back and not do anything, aside
right.
from the political process and getting the government involved in the big ticket solutions. Also, as individuals and as a public, we have to do our part. Everybody's got to carry their own bucket.
Right. That's great. That's good.
So in terms of your own process, you've been aware of climate change since forever.
Well, not forever, but 2000, yeah, a long time.
Long time.
18 years.
And you've been pretty much fully engaged in being an activist on the subject since the training?
2006, right.
Right. So you've seen a lot of trends and evolutions.
Right. I've seen, and it's, I used to do, when I was Secretary of State, I would do town hall meetings literally all over the state.
Uh-huh.
Where I'd do town hall meetings where I would make a climate presentation and then have a discussion with people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really great because when you're Secretary of State, you can have town hall meetings and a lot of people will come.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. That was great.
Right.
And then after I was done... being Secretary of State, I was appointed by Governor Kulongoski to serve on the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, which basically oversees energy development and salmon and wildlife in the Columbia Basin.
Mm-hmm.
So I then did just an immense number of presentations to high schools. It's been really interesting to see the change in student attitudes. When I first started doing presentations to high schools, and I would do whole assemblies of, you know, a couple hundred students.
Right.
There were always, when this would be when I first started doing it, probably in 2009 or whatever, there would always be a number of deniers. And now, when I do presentations to students, no deniers, none.
It really seems like the kids are on top of it.
The kids very much are, they know it's going on. And the real challenge presenting to kids is to really convince them that we really can solve this problem. We really can deal with this problem. We really can change the outcome. We don't just have to have the climate changing and everything burning up and being acidified.
Total science fiction disaster.
Right. We don't have to.
Well, I'm so glad you put it that way, because that was kind of the next question I had for you, which is that most of the people that I run into who are maybe not completely immersed in this feel kind of fatalistic, like they feel helpless, there's not much we can do about it, that kind of thing. And you're giving a pretty hopeful message here.
Oh, I am.
Can you speak to those folks?
I am pretty hopeful. And I think the reality is there's a huge amount we can do cost effectively. I want to emphasize that if you get more and more of your energy from places like solar and wind, you basically don't contribute more carbon to the atmosphere. And the fact of the matter is, for new energy resources, the least expensive energy resources today are solar and wind. So I have a great deal of hope that our economic system basically, you know, looks for the lowest cost resource and then implements that. And I think we have a marvelous opportunity, because the lowest cost resource are two resources that basically don't contribute more carbon to the atmosphere. So we can really get more and more of our electricity from non-carbon sources. We're already blessed in the Northwest because we have the Bonneville Power Administration, and they get most of their energy from dams, hydroelectric dams on the Columbia, so they're not carbon sources. The only problem with the dams on the Columbia, which we're real aware of, is that it's made it real difficult for those marvelous creatures, the salmon, to migrate home to Idaho, going through all those dams. So that's the downside for hydro, is the blockage that it creates for salmon. What's really great is it's very cost effective now to use solar and use wind. They're the cheapest energy resources.
And a lot of things like turning off your lights and things like that, they either save you money, they're free, or they're much less costly than the alternative. So it's all very economically viable for the individual as well as our government organizations.
Right, very much so.
Yeah.
And that's what, I got to say, that's what gives me some real hope, that we've really seen a change in the economics, and that really leads me to think we can, in fact, make this change.
Hold your next thought. I just have to say, you're listening to KCIW LP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. Thanks for that. All right, so let's see. We're talking about the economics of going to the alternative fuel sources. And really, we just have to get off petrochemicals in general. But I wanted to make that little footnote about the salmon. I imagine that there are people right now designing dams and alternative ways for the salmon to have an easier time getting upstream.
There definitely
are. And we've always had the salmon ladders and so on, but I imagine that now people are more aware of that problem. Right. They're going to fix it.
Well, and there are, there really are some really remarkable technologies coming online. There's this this one that I think has some real potential. It's a, what would you call it, a salmon chute, or a, it's about as big as a salmon, bigger, but about as big.
Uh-huh.
And basically you put a salmon in it, and then you push the salmon through, and so it goes, and you can use it over low head dam. So you can get salmon from below a dam to above a dam with no damage to the salmon, just shooting it up in this. It's this amazing new technology. It's a, I don't know what to call it, the salmon cannon.
Right, right.
You know,
shooting salmon into the air. I have a cartoon picture that's
right
in my head
that's
already.
It's fine. That's what you should have. It's a cartoon picture. But it's it really works. They really survive, and they aren't damaged. And it's
probably
just,
saves them energy, not having to climb up all that rocky
and,
stuff.
You know, it's... It's really been incredible where they've used it. It's really worked well. So that's, you know, there's alternatives like that that can give us, continue to give us, you know, naturally spawning salmon and clean energy like hydroelectric. The other thing that we're really seeing that I think it's going to happen real quick, and I don't think we've quite seen it yet, is you're going to really see a transition in cars.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to see a transition to electric cars. And, you know, there are 50 automakers around the world that are all producing electric cars now. There's a huge number of electric cars being produced, and it just hasn't really taken over the U.S. auto market yet, but it's going to happen, and it's going to happen sort of so quickly that people will just go, oh, do you remember the days when we used to drive those fossil fuel cars?
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to happen.
I've heard rumors of this as well, that this coming year they're going to be introducing many new models of electric cars.
Well,
and the other fallacy about it that I always want to explore is that I think we think of electric cars as being kind of gutless. You know, we're used to our big gas-consuming things, and then we can possibly use them for trucking and so on. But it turns out that it's the opposite. Yeah.
Right. No, and I've been in I was test driving a Tesla, which is an electric car, and if you want acceleration, don't talk to me about gas cars. Let's get in an electric car and look out.
Yeah.
They go just boom, and they're just like,
well, so
very
much of
rapid.
our production of greenhouse gases has to do with our transportation system, trucking and all the transportation of goods. Aside from the passenger cars, so that the electric can solve that problem too is really important. I'm very glad to hear that.
Yeah, and it's coming. I mean, it's really coming, and it's sort of like I'm sort of, you know, just like expecting it to just. It's going to be one of those things that just sort of transforms kind of suddenly.
Yeah,
it's like it's just going to go.
Yeah.
And it's going to shift. And there'll still be gas stations for a while, but not for that long.
I know. It's like when you see an old movie now and they have a cell phone that's like the size of a shoebox pushed up to their head. It's going to look really silly. And
Yeah. I remember that. I mean, I had a cell phone back in, what would it be? I don't know,
1970-something?
78 or 80.
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s.
It was huge.
Yeah.
It was like this huge thing. I mean, I look at what we have now, these little cell phones, you know, iPhones that have not just a telephone, but a whole lot of other stuff.
I know.
On the internet, and it's just like...
Thinking about this the other day, I bet this is... This cell phone that I'm holding in my hand, this iPhone, is probably more powerful than our early desktop computers for individual use.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, Pi White tells me, too, as a techie person, that's absolutely true. So that's pretty impressive.
Oh, no question. I mean, I can remember, I had an Apple II computer in
Apple IIe, yes.
Right, Apple, exactly.
We all had them.
Apple IIe, and it was, the amazing thing about it was it had 40 megabytes of memory.
Oh, I know, it's crazy, oh my God.
And that was huge.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And now, 40 megabytes,
I mean, nothing.
Nothing.
I know. And the thing is, just to bring it back to the present, all these technology things are happening at a more accelerating pace every day. I mean, even being involved in climate change like I am, the things that we gave a class on 2 years ago are now so out of date, we can't give that same class
right.
anymore.
Right.
We have to absolutely redo every reference in it because it's all outdated. Things have moved so fast technically as well as the acceleration of the change itself.
Right.
Yes. So we're in for some pretty exciting times here.
Yes. Pretty, they'll have changes coming for sure.
Yeah.
And, some of it's good, some of it's bad, and hang on.
Exactly. So coming back to the political side of things, one of the changes that I've been noticing lately is that our national politicians, our candidates for the Democratic nomination, people like that, they're talking about climate change now. Governor Inslee, his whole platform was climate change. Too bad he didn't make it, but
right.
even so, that's different. 6 months ago, people wouldn't do that. Now it's part of everybody's general talk.
I agree.
And you're seeing that from your vantage point, too, I'm sure,
right.
if there's anything.
I'm very, very thankful that we're now to the point where people are just like facing it mm-hmm. and being realistic about it and not, for a long time there were people who just like felt it was their duty to deny it.
Right.
It's sort of like, I mean, weather, you can deny it all you want, but it's going on, it's getting worse. And it's very, I feel very good that people have now, aside from our president, have really mm-hmm. shifted their understanding. And then particularly young people just say, oh man, it's clearly changing.
And really, the young people are the ones that are driving, I mean, not the young people per se, but the public is what's driving the politicians changing their tune,
right.
in my opinion, I can see.
That's what I hope.
And I think there might even be some little cracks starting to form in the Republican wall against it as well. A couple people here and there sticking their toe in the water.
I think so. I think it's, I think it cannot survive as a partisan issue. It just can't be.
It's going to take everybody.
It's going to take, exactly. You said it exactly. It's going to take everybody, and increasingly people understand that. And it's not a partisan issue, or it shouldn't be. And so basically, it's still a little bit partisan right now,
mm-hmm.
but I sort of just hold my breath and hope it changes fairly quickly. Because I think it has to.
Yeah, absolutely. And watching that change being pushed from below, it brings to mind the question, I often hear people talk about, well, in World War II, we mobilized. In getting a
yes.
man on the moon, we mobilized.
Yes.
But do we still have that in our community psyche as Americans?
Well, and I guess I think we do. I hope, I don't know, but I hope we do. I think those are two very good examples. World War II is one really good example. Man on the Moon is another really good example. And, dealing with carbon hopefully will be the third example that this country, and now it's not just this country, but the whole globe comes together to say, let's do what we can about this.
And is your impression that other countries are getting the bit between their teeth better than we are?
Yes. My impression is that very clearly some of the other major energy consumers. China, for example, they are just making huge, I mean, they're because their economy's growing mm-hmm. so much, they continue to use too much coal. But if you look at where they're getting more and more of their newer energy, it's from solar and wind. And so actually in India is the same way. It's incredible how much energy India is now getting from solar. I mean, it's, you know, you get a lot of sunshine in India, but they're really committing more and more of their resources to getting energy. That sun shines free. So if sure you build the infrastructure to capture the sun's energy, guess what? You're and done really, spending money. You've got it.
Exactly. And I believe, if I'm correct in this, the technology for the alternatives is actually simpler than the old petrochemical technology. So it's actually a boon for these developing countries to be alternative and not having to go the petrochemical.
Very good point.
You know.
Right. And very good point. It's actually much less expensive for them to, they just jump over the technology that we grew up with. Mm-hmm. They jump over it and get to the new technology.
And I imagine that in our country, that's one of the things that's holding us back, that the petrochemical companies, which we have been so... has been so part and parcel of our culture and our economy. They're so deeply invested in all of their hard assets that produces stuff. And so how do they survive that transition with all that stuff on their books? I don't know much about this. I'm not an economist.
I think what you said is absolutely true. And I don't know much about it either. I don't know how they survive. I don't know how Union 76 or Phillips or Texaco. I don't know, because they're basically companies that just boomed when we went into using a huge amount of oil. And they haven't been around forever. They've made a whole lot of money given as long as we use lots of petroleum. Mm-hmm. But as we start to use less and less petroleum, yeah, I'm not sure what's in their future.
So it makes one understand a little better why they are so, you know, tooth and nail fighting everything. Maybe not overtly where you can see it, but it's a lot of what's driving the denier politics.
Yes.
Yeah.
A whole lot. And you say it very well, because they're getting sort of, what would I say, they're getting smarter in that they don't want to be clearly identified as fighting changes to solar and wind and other, you know, and electric cars and the like. But the reality is they want to drag their feet as much as they can, because in the meantime, they can sell more petroleum.
So then they're hoping for, I imagine, a soft landing where as their stuff becomes obsolete, they're getting more into alternatives, and that could be a more gradual process for them that would allow them to survive. But in the meantime, we need change now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and scientists are saying it's a little bit scary. Scientists are saying, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, mm-hmm. which is the UN panel of scientists from all over the world, years ago, you know, they were talking about 2040, 2050, 2060.
Yeah.
They're now talking that we're, unless we really reduce our methane and carbon into the atmosphere in the next 10 years, we're going to see really dramatic climate change, you know, forest fires, storms, floods, etc. It gets to a point where it just gets worse and worse. And scientists, you know, used to say, 2030, 2040, 2050.
2050, I know.
And now they're saying, 2030 is about the outside. Mm-hmm. And if we don't deal with it by, if we don't really reduce carbon by then, it's going to just exacerbate.
And that doesn't
change.
Mean we can start in 10 years. We have to start now.
No, that
to make drastic change to get to those goals in
that
time.
Thank you. That's exactly right.
And people often say, "Oh well, we've got 12 years. You know, I'll wait 11 years and 9 months."
Not going to work. And that's, I mean, you know, the House Bill 2020 is a good example in that, you know, it's a fairly it's basically a proposal that says you're going to be paying more and more for the carbon you use. It's basically increasing taxes on carbon.
Right.
That's basically what it is. And so it's not an insignificant tax increase. Let's be real clear. It's in the next 10 years, it's almost $2 billion of tax increase in the state of Oregon.
That's a lot for
our
economy.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not. I don't mean to say, oh, no big deal. It is a big deal. But here's the reality. The reality is, you look at that tax increase compared to the fires we had, the Chetco Bar fire, other fires we had, global ocean acidification that's taken place off of Newport, killing all the crabs and oysters and other. I mean, it's just totally transforming life as we know it.
Yes.
And you sort of say, well, what's that worth?
Exactly, because that's not on our economic models that we use as a kind of a national balance sheet of what's happening.
No.
And yet it's going to destroy us.
Right. And that's the challenge is, I mean, it's like that's a big tax increase, but it's moving us. That would move us in the right direction of using less carbon and contributing less to the atmosphere.
Well, it's not going to be completely without pain. I mean, any kind of change is going to have winners and losers. And on a personal level, change is uncomfortable.
Right.
But it's the alternative is a lot uglier.
That's a hard position to hold, that, you know, this alternative, it's not hard to hold that position when people start to really experience those alternatives on a annual basis or every other year basis, where they start to see what the impacts of climate change are in terms of forest fires and in terms of ocean acidification and in terms of glaciation. All those things are starting to become very real to people, so they can really say, well, let me see, let's do a little balancing here.
But getting that information to the hands of the average person who may not be as tuned in is key to the whole thing. Strategically, that's what's got to happen, so that people know they have a choice. It's not hopeless.
No, I agree. I totally agree with you. It's critical that people not think it's hopeless. There are things that we can all do, and I totally agree with you about that.
I'm just going to take a moment here to say you're listening to KCIW LP Curry Coast Community Radio 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. So talking about our local impacts, one of the things that feels challenging to me about doing my part in Curry County is that other than the fire and other than the fishing, but in terms of our daily lifestyle here, we're not that impacted. We don't have the 120 degree weather that even Medford has and many, many other places, or, you know, in terms of affecting each and every one of us in our daily lives here, we're pretty insulated. Conversely, though, I'm in real estate, amongst other things. I'm aware that we have a lot of climate refugees, and we have limited resources in terms of our water coming from the Chetco River, and it's already pretty committed as it is.
Yep.
You know, we're going to have a pretty serious density resource problem on our horizon here that's going to affect property values a lot. Which means affordable housing is going to be even more of a disaster than it already is. There's a lot of these local impacts that I'm quite concerned about, and I know you've been thinking about local impacts too. How are you seeing that picture these days?
I agree with you. It's become a bigger and bigger challenge. The local impacts get more and more significant. As you start to look at, here's what's so amazing. Mm-hmm. You just listed some of the things that we have already felt. We're not feeling that impacted compared to living in Texas.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And you're right. And if you ask scientists, what part of the United States is likely to be the least impacted by climate change?
Pacific Northwest.
Their answer would be the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
And you've put your finger on one of the huge issues, which is climate refugees. Because believe me, people in Texas, they can't continue to live there very quickly. It's not going to be a habitable place. So where are they going to go? Well, not all of them, but some of them are sure going to come here because it's known as a place that's really less impacted by climate.
4 out of 5 of my buyers already are mentioning climate as their main motivation.
Okay, so you're right there.
I am.
You're seeing it.
Yeah.
So that's pretty incredible. And, you know, I would say that I'm very pleased that we in Oregon have a land use planning system that prevents us from just, you know, developing willy-nilly. But the land use planning system is just designed to get growth put in sensible places, not stop growth.
Mm-hmm.
So as you get more and more demand for housing, there's nothing in the land use planning system that prevents building more and more houses. It's just you want to build them in the least impactful places where you can do get utilities to them, get transit to them, all those other things. But it doesn't prevent us from growing. It just says, let's grow in a smart way. So.
And here we have less than 2% of our county that is buildable, and it's mostly built. Plus, there's other issues with building these days. The contractor skill sets are kind of, all the old guys are retiring. And there's a lot of reasons why building doesn't make sense anymore. So that's kind of exasperating things, too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So, you know, we live in a place that's really great in terms of for the climate compared to other places like South Texas headed into Mexico. I mean, forget it.
Or like Florida, that's going to be mostly underwater by the
right.
time this thing's over.
Right.
Not and just Miami, the whole bloody state.
No, really.
Maybe Louisiana too, you
right.
know.
No, lots of Louisiana.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, a whole lot
that
of Louisiana.
That whole southern area is at risk.
Right. It's just, and you sort of go, holy moly.
And where are those people going to go?
Where are those people going to go? And they're going to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's pretty likely to predict that a bunch of them are going to come here.
Yeah.
Because this is a good place to come.
Yeah.
And, wow. It's just something to be aware of and to be aware is happening. I would say once again, you know, we're less impacted than Southern Texas, but we're not unimpacted. We're very much impacted by climate change, and we're seeing some real changes in our ability to live fruitful lives here.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
just
now, in terms of alternative energy sources, local wise, I've heard that the wind off the coast here is the most high velocity, sustainable wind anywhere, and yet some people have said there's problems with making that work and so on and so forth. Are you up on that part of the technical
yes,
side?
Yes, I've done quite a bit of studying about floating wind turbines.
Mm-hmm.
The wind resource off the 100 miles off the wind resource off of southern Oregon, the 100 miles from the California border north, and 200 miles south the California line, about 25 miles out, mm-hmm. 25 miles out to sea. There is a phenomenal wind resource that is just abundant, consistent, and really strong. And it's there, and you know, Principal Power and some other companies are really starting to tap it down. They're doing some developing of wind turbines that they float out to sea, and they were originally going to locate in Coos Bay, and now they're located in Eureka. I'd be very honest with you and say I'm hoping that we can get them and other wind companies back mm-hmm. to Coos Bay, because there's a really great deep water port there, and there's no bridge, highway bridge, until you're way into Coos Bay. So it basically, you can develop big wind turbines and big things that you can haul to sea on the North Spit in Coos Bay and really get them out. And it's a phenomenal resource. There's a similar area off the East Coast, but it's about 300 miles out from the shore. Here, it's somewhere around 25 miles out.
That's
so
amazing.
So that makes it, it's not insignificant, but it makes it much more realistic to bring power ashore from floating wind turbines. And that's what they've started to do offshore Eureka. And California's adopted an incredible policy that says by 2045, they will have no carbon in their electrical generation. So they will basically be producing all their power from solar and wind and geothermal and other kinds of, and hydro, non-carbon resources. And that policy has been adopted by the California legislature. It's just an incredibly visionary policy. And the reality is they're going to need the offshore wind to meet the energy demand in California, just because they sure can't just do it on onshore wind, because there are not enough places to do it. So they need the consistent, strong offshore wind to meet that demand.
So, but they're California-based. If we want that resource in Oregon, we have to create a different entity, or do you hope they're just going to develop here as well?
Well, it's basically,
how does that fit together?
We
don't know yet.
it's very complicated, because here you have the Coos Curry Electric Co-op, which is a Bonneville Power utility. Okay, so most of the energy that's coming to Coos Curry Electric Co-op comes from the Columbia River.
Yes.
Not all of it, but most of it.
Which is already pretty clean.
Well, it's very clean, except for there's an issue with salmon, which they're trying to solve. But it's very clean other than that, no carbon. And there's a real demand for clean energy quicker in California.
And a bigger consumer base, I imagine, to finance it.
And there's a real demand that's been put in place by the legislature.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, it's a resource that California needs first, but it's a resource that Oregon needs as well. So it's, over time, the initial markets can go, the turbines can sell their power to California, but in the long run, we're going to need power like that in mm-hmm. Oregon as well.
Mm-hmm. And what about solar? Solar still seems, for a lot of people, an impractical alternative as individuals, as consumers, and in terms of having our own systems or seeing those systems put in place.
Well, they're sort of like, I think there's sort of different kinds of views. I mean, on one hand, there's solar energy for individual homeowners. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's solar energy that's utility scale.
Right.
That is what's called photovoltaic, mm-hmm. which is sun producing electricity.
And we don't have really demand because we're already hydroelectric here,
right.
Personally.
We don't yet.
Generally speaking.
Right. That's correct. And frankly, in this area, the most sensible resource we have is offshore wind and the hydro we already get. That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Solar, particularly photovoltaic, probably is not going to happen around here for a while. But there are some big photovoltaic systems in California and in Oregon. There are some up for particularly east where the sun shines 330 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
There's some big photovoltaic
systems. It has become more economically realistic that we can be using that in our mix.
Right.
Yeah. And we wouldn't be correct here to get let you go without talking about the Coos Bay. So you bring up Coos Bay, Jordan Cove.
Yeah.
And you've got some opinions about that, I imagine.
So let's talk about what Jordan Cove is. Jordan Cove is a cove on Coos Bay where a Canadian company, mm-hmm. Pembina, is proposing to build an export terminal where they take gas from the pipeline. It's gas from Colorado, it's gas from Wyoming, it's gas from Canada, comes down the pipeline, and they build a pipeline from near Klamath Falls, Malin, 230 miles over to the coast in Coos Bay, and they put it into this facility, and they compress the gas to liquefy it. It's very cold. It's like 260 degrees below zero.
Wow.
I mean, it's like a huge amount of energy taken to compress the gas to make it really cold and liquid, and then they put it in tankers and ship it to Japan, Vietnam, other places.
Uh-huh.
So that's the proposal, and it is a real disaster for the Southern Oregon coast, a real disaster for Coos Bay in terms of the safety of that facility in Coos Bay. You got the pipeline, you got all the leaks of methane out of the pipeline, and then you've got the incredible amount of energy that gets consumed. The Jordan Cove Energy Project will be the largest energy consumer in Oregon once Boardman would be the largest energy producer once the Boardman coal plant is closed in 2020. In Oregon, it will be the largest energy producer because that's how much energy they're going to produce to compress the gas.
So, in other words, we're increasing the marketplace for a petrochemical situation.
Right.
And we also
you're selling it overseas.
Right.
And they're then going to burn it.
Right, exactly. And then also we run the risk of leaks, other kinds of environmental impacts,
right.
I imagine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, let's talk about pipelines for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not an expert on pipelines.
Right.
But pipelines have a 100-foot swath through wherever they're going through. And this pipeline goes through, crosses the Rogue River, the Umpqua River, the Coos River, goes through a number of old growth forests.
Very burnable forests. What happens
when the burnable
forest meets a pipeline and we have a giant forest fire?
Right.
Oh my God.
It's not pretty. The pipeline has a huge impact, and then it's just this huge impact in Coos Bay where you're compressing the gas and shipping it over to Japan or China or wherever, where they are then going to burn it and put more methane and CO2 into the atmosphere. What a bad idea.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. We're running out of time. There's so much more we could be talking about, but I don't want to leave without asking you a little bit about what the individual listening to this who wants to make a difference in terms of politics or whatever you suggest people should actually do.
Obviously there are things each of us should do to make sure that our homes are as energy efficient as possible. That's
number one.
Number two, I really think it's really important that we try to eat as much local food as possible. Now, my daughters are both farmers in Langlois. Mm. They raise a huge amount of stuff, lettuce and salad greens and carrots and potatoes and beets and da da da. And you're so much better off eating locally. A, it's better, tastes better,
and
but
healthier.
B, it's like climate impact wise, much less serious climate impact compared
right.
to all the energy that gets consumed in this sort of mega agriculture world we live in. So, do what you can to make your home as energy efficient as possible. Eat locally, you'll enjoy it a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a prescription that is really tasty.
Mm-hmm.
How we get around cars, if you can make a transition. I drive a Toyota Prius, get about 45 to 50 miles to the gallon. I'm going to transition to an electric car, as soon as my Prius basically dies. But I've got 250,000 miles on it so far, and it's running great.
They'll run forever.
So I'll just keep going as long as I can. But I'd say those are the things that each mm-hmm. of us can do: our homes, eating locally, driving, so that we don't do so much.
Of course, voting
fuel.
And writing your legislators.
Oh yes,
yes,
yes. That's critical. And as we learned in the last session, we had the Democrats ready to enact really forward-thinking legislation, and we had the Republicans basically saying, "Nah, we're not going to do that."
Yeah.
And
I guess the other thing that's so important right now is to learn as much as you can and tell your friends and neighbors and anybody who's going to listen what you've learned.
Right.
Because it's about getting everybody mobilized. Bill, thank you so much for being with us. This has been Bill Bradbury talking to us about climate and related subjects. It's been fantastic having you here. Really great information. And I want to thank also Pi Y, co-producer and technical support. This has been Lee Tooley for Reality Check on KCIW. Thank you for listening.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.